Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Dr. Raj podcast with Dr. Raj Desgupta, a show all about educating patients, students, and aspiring doctors about better patient care. Dr. Raj is a quadruple board certified physician and associate professor at the University of Southern California. He was a co-host of the TNT series Chasing the Cure with Ann Curry, as well as a regular on the TV show The Doctors. And now, here's our show.
For drug therapy, you know what I mean? Let's talk about hormone replacement, just as a broad term. Are there roles for estrogen, testosterone, something called a calcitonin, or these estrogen wannabes? These, I think they're called SERMs, select estrogen receptor modulators.
Yeah.
What about these hormone thingies? Is there a big role for them?
There absolutely is no doubt that that these therapies you mentioned help decrease bone loss, stabilize bone density, and more importantly, decrease fracture risk.
Okay.
So even hormone replacement therapy for a menopausal woman, estrogen with progesterone as needed, if needed in the presence of the uterus. But the estrogen is really kind of the key player here, as we talked about, that women, postmenopausal women who use estrogen therapy have less bone loss and lower risks of fractures as compared to women who don't go on hormone replacement therapy, assuming that they're not using some other osteoporosis medication. So do I think that hormone replacement therapy has a role here? For some women, yes. If a woman is taking hormone replacement therapy for another reason, I think, you know, for most people now, the most clear indication to go on hormone replacement therapy is for the treatment of hot flashes. And so for a woman who is taking hormone replacement therapy to treat hot flashes, there's no doubt that that woman will benefit in terms of her bones as well, right?
But one of the main reasons, and I probably just steal your thunder here, is that it's the side effects, right? Estrogen. Why that's not the standard of care for osteoporosis, right?
Sure, right. So I think over the years, hormone replacement therapy used to be very much a first-line therapy to help reduce the risk of osteoporotic fracture. And to your point, it has fallen down the chain a little bit for many practitioners. And as far as sort of the mainstream guidelines out there go, hormone replacement therapy has fallen down to sort of a lower tier option because we have other pharmacotherapies that are very effective, and other pharmacotherapies that don't have the increased risk of breast cancer and potentially of VTE,
clotting out there.
That estradiol therapy does.
Now, I'm not going to let you go yet. The SERMs, you know, I mean, there are certain drugs out there, hormones out there, they're only activating certain receptors. So it's not like giving here some estrogen,
right?
These are ones that will attack certain receptors that really will benefit that bone turnover, lack of term. Do you use those drugs? I think their brand names are like Evista, give me some money, or known as raloxifene. Do you still use those drugs?
Yeah, so raloxifene is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, just like you said. And on the most basic level, it blocks estrogen activity in the breast tissue. So it actually decreases the risk of breast cancer, obviously a good thing.
Yeah.
And it acts like estrogen in the bone, which obviously also a good thing. So it seems like a very much an ideal drug. It is still used out there, and it is still FDA approved as a medication to reduce the risk of osteoporotic fracture. It also has sort of fallen down the chain a little bit in terms of guideline recommendations
okay.
for osteoporosis treatment because there are some risks associated with it. So the clotting risk is still there, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an increased risk of blood clots, potentially also an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, and strokes.
Okay.
Although the risk is probably small in the average person.
Yeah.
The main reason why raloxifene has sort of fallen down the chain is that when you look at fracture prevention, it seems to do a pretty good job at reducing the risk of vertebral fractures, fractures in the spine.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have as good of a track record in terms of reducing the risk of non-vertebral fractures.
Ah.
So if we think about hip fractures, wrist fractures, osteoporotic or fragility fractures outside
that
of the spine.
Sense.
Now, obviously, a huge percentage of osteoporotic fractures do occur in the spine. So it's not like raloxifene is useless. It certainly is better than nothing for
mm-hmm.
certain patients.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it's fallen down is because we have other options that have proven fracture reduction of fracture risk in both the spine and outside of the spine.
So I know we don't use this a lot for osteoporosis, but for people who may have come across the word calcitonin, not
mm-hmm.
a very popular drug, I think
mm-hmm.
it's a nasal spray, right?
So calcitonin, when it's used for osteoporosis fracture prevention, yes, it's administered as a nasal spray.
And let me explain, calcitonin is actually something that's going to build your bones. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the opposite of like a parathyroid hormone that's going to like, you know, break stuff down, right? It builds your bones.
Unfortunately, not exactly.
Okay.
Calcitonin is still considered an anti-resorptive agent, meaning
okay.
that its end result, its end mechanism is that it inhibits osteoclasts.
Okay.
So the mechanism by which calcitonin would help your bones
mm-hmm.
is it would inhibit the demolition crew.
It inhibits the demolition crew.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So all the medications we've talked about thus far are all medications that inhibit the osteoclast, that
okay.
That slow down the demolition crew.
Okay. And that one, just why do we use it? Simply put, it's just no one wants to snort the drug.
That's
have poor data.
That's
too much.
That's one part of it.
Yeah.
The ability to reduce the risk of fracture, probably not as strong as many of our other agents. There's also some concerns that it might be associated with a cancer risk, multiple
Ew.
Different types of cancer.
Okay.
Although that was, you know, not such a strong problem that it was, you know, taken off the market or anything.
Yeah.
It still is available, but it's definitely fallen down the chain.
Any
sure.
of your partners or yourself prescribe calcitonin to anyone for osteoporosis?
I have at this current time zero patients on it for osteoporosis. I've inherited patients who were on it, and I generally take them off of it.
And last thing for hormones, I'm in the hormone mood right now.
Yeah,
men, me and you,
mm-hmm.
testosterone.
So testosterone would be expected to be helpful for bone health in men if they have low testosterone.
So you have to get the blood work first.
Correct. You have to prove that that a given man has low testosterone
okay.
first
mm-hmm.
before you would think that the benefits of starting testosterone replacement therapy, exogenous testosterone, would outweigh the risks of testosterone therapy.
Now, this leads to my second question.
Mm-hmm.
If someone, before giving drug therapy to a man,
mm-hmm.
would you say testosterone first and make sure those levels are adequate? Because when we talk about women, we're not saying estrogen first. We're saying drug first based on safety and all these things put together. How's it for men?
For men, the recommendation would be any man that you diagnose with osteoporosis based on fracture history, DEXA,
mm-hmm.
and or fracture risk assessment
mm-hmm.
tool, you should get a testosterone level on that man.
Mm-hmm.
Quick note on the testosterone levels, make sure you get them in the morning and make sure you get them while the patient is fasting.
Me and you have a lot of banter about
mm-hmm.
endocrine
mm-hmm.
stuff. I mean, cortisol, mm-hmm. super high in the morning, low at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Is testosterone what you call diurnal? Or
Correct.
So it's naturally in the morning, it's what?
Higher in the morning,
oh.
lower in the afternoon and the evening.
Significantly?
Yeah, yeah, and in many men the difference is significant,
okay. wow.
and so in a man who is truly hypogonadal, he should have low testosterone levels all day long, including in the morning.
Okay.
But a man with normal gonadal function may have testosterone levels that appear to be low because the reference ranges that you see on a lab report are constructed using early morning peak testosterones.
What about the fasting?
The fasting part.
You mean full-on fasting? Like
an eight-hour fast.
What happens if I eat? What happens to my testosterone if I eat?
Testosterone levels drop after eating, especially after consuming carbohydrates in the morning.
Is it because insulin has influence on testosterone?
It's probably a variety of different factors, but yeah, I'm sure.
You see how I kind of quickly pulled that out?
I love men. You're always all the hormones, Dr. Rush. I love it. Yeah.
Okay, no, these are great. Okay, so.
To answer your question, every man with osteoporosis should get a testosterone level check. If the testosterone is low, confirmed to be low, obviously look for a cause. That's another podcast. but that man should be then started on testosterone therapy unless contraindicated. And then probably though also you would start that patient on pharmacotherapy in addition to the testosterone.
Okay,
not in place of.
Gotcha. So now we're going to go away from hormonal therapies and go into medications, right? And I put the medications into three categories, you know, bisphosphonates, which you allude to, which is kind of like the workhorse, the go-to, been around even when you were probably a med student, you know what I mean? These can be taken orally, can be taken through the IV. Then there's biologics, always a hot topic, you know what I mean? And we'll talk about, you know, one specific one, denosumab. And I've called the other ones anabolic agents, you know, and I'm going to call these mimickers of things, like a mimicker of parathyroid hormone. We'll talk about that. Well, let's start with bisphosphonates. Is that you mentioned that's kind of like your go-to, and why is that? Is it price? Is it ease of taking it? Is it just data? Why bisphosphonates?
A lot of different reasons. The bisphosphonates remain kind of the for your average. Your average high risk patient, I guess, you know, your average osteoporosis patient, bisphosphonates are going to be your go-to. Bisphosphonates have been around for a long time. Yes, definitely around, you know, when I was, they were probably around when you were a med student.
They probably were, but
they've been around for decades. Yeah. Bisphosphonates have a long track record. We know, generally how they work. We know that they are effective. We know that they're generally pretty safe, especially if we, you know, follow some sort of proper precautions.
Sure.
And so they are sort of a good long-term medication, a very potent osteoclast inhibitor. So a very potent inhibitor of the demolition crew.
Yeah.
And most importantly, associated with a decreased risk of fracture for the most part, for most of the bisphosphonates, a decreased risk of fracture, both in the spine and outside of the spine.
Now, in the olden days, they, God forbid, there was a daily dosing of the drug, oral, and it has its side effects, you know, and I don't want to get into the esophagus and everything, but do you now prescribe it weekly? Do you prescribe it monthly, or you're more of like a once yearly IV type of guy?
I prescribe all three. I have patients that are on all three.
No one uses daily anymore, right?
No, I haven't seen a patient on daily on a daily bisphosphonate in a while. Okay. I think it is still available, but probably harder to come by.
Okay.
The sort of standard formulation, which is the cheapest formulation and thus what's most widely available and most widely covered by insurance plans, is a once weekly formulation of alendronate. So that's going to be, you know, probably the most widely available, most easy to get formulation. Safe, effective.
Yeah.
I have plenty of patients that take that. You brought up once monthly oral formulation as
Pay me some money. Boniva.
There we go. Boniva and Actonel or Mesedronate.
Are they taken off?
They both are still available. I would say maybe you should run with Resedronate a little bit more and try to see if you can get something from them. But because the sort of feeling now is there's maybe slightly more data showing that Resedronate helps with both vertebral and non-vertebral fractures. Mm-hmm. With the Ibandronate, we see maybe not as robust data to back up the non-vertebral.
I'm going to tell people it's hard to take medications once a day or multiple times a day, but why doesn't they take off? Is it price is the main reason you don't take it? I like a once a month pill. That's not a big deal.
For right now, the reason is mostly price, I think.
Okay.
Just that it actually, you know, even though these drugs are generic, there are generic versions, that the monthly formulations are more expensive than the weekly formulation.
Okay.
So a lot of insurance plans out there will say you got to try the weekly first before we'll pay for the monthly.
But from a clinician standpoint, if someone said, hey, Dr. Barnett, I just want to go on a monthly drug. You're okay with that,
right? Absolutely. I have no problem with it.
Now, what about the yearly IV? My mom took the yearly IV. I believe brand name is Reclast.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. I didn't take it, but I'm saying it. Why not that?
I have lots of patients on IV Reclast once a year. A lot of people, given the option of taking a pill either once a week or once a month, following some, you know, very specific instructions on how to take it versus coming in for a once a year IV infusion. A lot of patients pick the infusion, and I usually, to be perfectly honest, if patients say, you know, I don't care, you pick for me, I'll usually pick the IV infusion for them.
Nice. And so regardless of those weekly, monthly, yearly, they're all the same good data, essentially.
More or less. Again, the only one that maybe is a little bit not up to par with the others is ebandronate or Boniva. But alendronate or Fosamax, risendronate, Actonel, zoledronic acid, Reclast, all looking pretty good.
Nice. Now let's go into these biologics. There's always something inhibiting something nowadays. We learned that from rheumatoid arthritis and COVID and everything.
Absolutely.
So denosumab really goes back to, and I know you wanted to say this, but I have to show off my medical knowledge. You know what I mean? You know, women or all of us get a little bit older that the osteoclasts really just take off. The reason this happened earlier is there's certain proteins that we have like osteoprogenin.
Osteoprotegerin.
Did I screw that up a little bit?
No, you did it perfectly. I was just echoing you.
Me? Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, estrogen influences that, right?
Yeah.
And then what happens is that that's going to attach to, you know, these little ligands. I think one of the words the med students want me to say to you is RANK ligand, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And this is a monoclonal antibody that's going to be blocking RANK ligand, which actually makes the osteoclast break down and get the demolition crew going, right?
Correct.
So it's a monoclonal antibody. Where does this fall relative to a bisphosphonate? Is this a second-line drug, a first-line drug? And it's injectable, right? You have to inject once a month, don't you?
Well, once every 6 months, twice a year.
6 months. So where does that fall to you in a patient? When should a patient talk about being on this biologic denosumab? I think the brand name is Prolia, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's also, you know, I'd say for sort of your lower to average risk osteoporosis patient, who we know is already at a higher risk of fracture to begin with. But for your patients who, you know, you're sort of maybe not as worried about them, probably Prolia or denosumab is going to be more of a second line treatment.
And if you're failing a bisphosphonate,
if you fail treatment with a bisphosphonate, you might think about Prolia or denosumab. And a lot of this is fueled by cost considerations. Prolia is a lot more expensive than all the bisphosphonates.
It still is. It's still it's not generic yet.
No.
Okay.
And it's been around for
a while,
about 13 years. It was approved by the FDA in 2010. So, but if you compare to the track record of bisphosphonates, it's shorter. So, you know, maybe if you're thinking about long-term safety and whatnot, we maybe have a little bit more with bisphosphonates.
So if someone is on a bisphosphonate, if they're having side effects or they're getting worsening based upon percent bone loss, that's when you'd only think about this biologic in the background.
That's one
right
situation
that?
Where you would.
Okay.
Another situation would be if you had a patient who is really high risk to begin with, right?
Yeah.
So maybe a patient who's already had a fracture or a patient whose bone density is really, really low or a patient who on the FRAX tool or whatever risk assessment model you use, their fracture risk is really, really high.
Mm-hmm.
You might think about using this as a first line treatment and some
before a bisphosphonate?
Perhaps.
Okay.
I do have to say that with Prolia, it's very, very important to realize that Prolia now, we realize that you should not do what we call a drug holiday with Prolia.
Ah.
In other words, if you start a patient on Prolia, that patient is either going to be on Prolia indefinitely / forever for the rest of their life, or if they're going to come off the Prolia, they must be transitioned to another agent, most typically a bisphosphonate. So when I have patients who come to me and they say, I want to take Prolia because I don't want to take a bisphosphonate because I heard that XYZ about bisphosphonates, I say, well, here's what you should know about Prolia. If I put you on Prolia today, you're either going to take it for the rest of your life, for all the years that you are on this planet, or I'm going to have to transit. If you ever want to come off of it, I'm going to have to transition you to another medication, at least for a while. And the medication that's most well studied in that circumstance is the bisphosphonate.
And the reason being is that the minute you stop the drug, your bone health is going to go immensely back down to bad.
You are correct.
It's
this rebound phenomenon. The analogy I use with my patients is, if you think of osteoporosis like a truck on a downhill slope, right? And there's a building or a brick wall or something at the bottom of that slope. And if the truck runs into the wall, that's like breaking a bone, okay?
Yeah.
Prolia is really, really good at keeping the brakes on the truck as long as you keep giving it every 6 or 7 months, twice a year. If you stop giving the Prolia and you don't replace it with something else, after about 7, 8, 9 months at the most, the antibodies, the monoclonal antibodies that are the denosumab, they go away. And all of a sudden, you get this very rapid activation of osteoclasts. The osteoclasts start chewing away at the bone even faster than probably if you had never put the patient on it in the first place. You see a dramatic drop in bone density, and you often see patients show up with fractures, sometimes multiple fractures. Probably the most commonly seen thing in these case series that came out were vertebral fractures at multiple levels. So this is why now if you look at the labeling for Prolia, all the guidelines out there, they make it very clear. If you put a patient on Prolia, you are basically telling that patient they're going to be on that medication for the rest of their life, or you have to make sure they understand that they cannot stop the medication without replacing it with something else.
That was worth the whole podcast right there. I don't think many patients do that. I didn't know that. That's amazing. Anabolics. Let's talk about one that's been around for a while, the parathyroid hormone analog that it mimics. Now, it's weird because parathyroid hormone, PTH, it breaks down the bone. It increases your calcium in the blood, keeping it simple for my fans over there.
Sure.
Now, you're telling me if I mimic this hormone, it should be breaking down more bone, but I'm using it for osteoporosis to build bone. Can you explain that? Is it a good drug? Do you use it in your patients?
It's a great drug, and I do use it in my patients. And so, yes, the idea that you alluded to, as I mentioned earlier, that primary hyperparathyroidism is actually a risk factor for bone loss and fracture. So the difference between primary hyperparathyroidism and using a PTH analog, a medication that basically looks and acts like parathyroid hormone, is that having tonic elevations, constant elevations in parathyroid hormone, leads to bone loss, leads to activation of the osteoclast and release or removal of calcium from the bone, right?
Bad.
If you have pulsatile elevations in parathyroid hormone, which occurs like if you were to administer this PTH analog that you're referring to, and you get an increase in parathyroid hormone that then goes away several hours later, a pulsatile increase in parathyroid hormone actually leads to more stimulation of the osteoblast relative to the osteoclast. So this is why it's considered an anabolic agent, and why it's good for the bones is that pulsatile increases in parathyroid hormone levels that go quickly up and then come back down, that leads to activation of the osteoblast.
And for my listeners, anabolic means build. That's why it's a building agent.
Right.
Now, how often do you dose paraparatide is the generic name for one of these. The brand name is Forteo. How often do you have to, it's an injection, right?
So it's a subcutaneous injection. So with a short little needle right under the skin, very similar to an insulin injection. It has to be injected once a day. Which a lot of patients do not like. But this is,
I don't want it.
I'll never attack you with a Forteo needle. So it's injected once a day. This is something that's administered by the patient, so they don't have to come into a doctor's office to get it. This is something that a patient or you know, the loved one at home would administer to them once a day, every day.
And you prescribed it?
Many patients.
So let's go back. So bisphosphonates first. There's denosumab committing you to the rest of your life. Where does teriparatide, you know, this PTH analog fall in? When do you consider that?
I think, you know, most of the thought process now out there is that basically we should be dividing our osteoporosis patients up into sort of like our osteoporosis patients and our severe osteoporosis patients, right?
Okay.
Or we might say our high risk for fracture patients and our very high risk for fracture patients.
Okay.
And so the differences there would be, has your patient already had a fracture? Because those patients we know are very high risk of having another fracture, right? Versus patients that we are just trying to perform primary prevention on. So patients that we are diagnosing solely on densitometric criteria or the risk assessment model. They might be only in this the high risk, but not the very high risk category. Patients who have really low T scores, which some would say is a T score that's less than negative 3.0. Some would say is a T score less than negative 3.5. They might be in the very high risk for fracture category.
So what does that mean? You're going to start them on those patients?
Right. So the reason that we make these two categories is that for the sort of standard high risk osteoporosis patient, a bisphosphonate is probably appropriate as initial therapy.
Okay.
For your very high risk category. So your patients who've already had a fracture, or your patients who have really low T-scores, or there's something else about them that you think this patient is really high risk for having a fracture. There is the notion out there that these patients, we should maybe be using more aggressive therapy with them from the get-go, right? So maybe not an oral bisphosphonate to start with.
Okay, so did they get the FDA approval for severe super osteoporosis? Is there data saying that it's more potent than a bisphosphate in these very severe osteoporosis patients?
From an FDA approval standpoint, not exactly. No, the FDA labeling doesn't say, you know, for use in patients that are very high risk.
Okay.
They still just say for use in helping to reduce the risk of fracture.
Is there data to compare it to a bisphosphonate?
So So the data out there would suggest that the very aggressive or more potent osteoporosis medications, which would include basically anything that is an injection or an infusion, is probably more potent in terms of reducing the risk of fracture than the oral bisphosphonates.
Gotcha. That's why you said oral, because the IV bisphosphonates may be just as good, air quote, as the anabolics.
So the ones we would put in that category of consider these for your high-risk patients would be IV reclast or IV zoledronic acid, the IV bisphosphonate, denosumab or Prolia, and then this other agent you just brought up, Forteo.
That makes sense. So it's not really the category, it's just giving it through the IV.
It seems like the parenteral, the non-oral administration seems to make a difference. Now, for the anabolic medications, and we're going to talk about the others, I'm sure.
Of course.
But the anabolic medications do seem that if you compare them to the anti-resorptive medications, they might have a slight edge even further, even beyond the IV reclass and the denosumab in terms of fracture risk reduction.
Wow. So, and you know, maybe I'm just asking too much, but I remember when I'm doing my board review class that in the olden days, teriparatide had some kind of labeling that there was a high risk for bone cancer, osteosarcoma. Maybe that was only seen in animals, you know what I mean? But I remember I memorized that. Is that, can we lay that to rest? The humans, me and you, we're not going to get no bone cancer from this drug, are we?
You're correct. So what the labeling said was just that when the medication was tested in rats, a specific type of rat, that some of the rats, their bones grew so much, their construction crew became so active that they started growing bone tumors, osteosarcoma, right?
Yep.
And so when teriparatide, Forteo, was approved for use in 2002, it had an FDA black box warning that said, it didn't say it causes osteosarcoma in humans. It said, we think it caused osteosarcoma in rats, and so maybe it could cause osteosarcoma in humans. It wasn't seen in any of the trials that were done up to that point, but they said, keep an eye out for it, right?
And if I was just your standard, you know, woman or man, and I just see a little risk of bone cancer, I don't think I'll go for the trials. I'm just get that drug away from me.
Sure, right. So, which is very understandable.
Yeah.
And so then 18 years later, in November 2020, 2 years ago, after accumulating now, you know, more than 20 years of data, if you take into account the trials that went on before FDA approval, the FDA downgraded it from a black box warning to just part of the labeling.
Oh.
And so now it is still in the labeling. But again, all it says is that some of the rats who got this medication developed osteosarcoma. So I think it's more a warning for rats than it is for humans. Not something that humans need to be too worried about.
So two more drugs, and we're still under anabolics, which are bone building, everyone. Mm-hmm. The reason why you're here, not because you're cool and my friend, there's this new thing, the first FDA-approved medication for men with osteoporosis. And, you know, we talked about these other drugs already, and I just assume men could take them. But this one, you know, you go to on the internet, and you look up these magazines, you know, they're like, yeah, FDA-approved. I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me these other drugs weren't FDA-approved for men? So let's talk about brand name Timlos, which is another type of teriparatide. I can't pronounce this right.
Abaloparatide.
Any thoughts about that?
So abaloparatide, which as of now there's only one brand name, Timlos, is an analog of another hormone called PTHRP, parathyroid hormone related peptide. So it looks, again, very similar to parathyroid hormone, but some slight differences. And essentially, the mechanisms are going to be very similar as to why it works and why it does what it does. It's also administered as an injection, a subcutaneous injection. It's also administered once a day. So, you know, in many ways, it's very similar. It's the sister drug to teriparatide, also known as Forteo. Many of these drugs we've talked about, in fact, all of the drugs we've talked about, have also been approved for use in men for a while, including teriparatide or Forteo. It's been FDA approved for use in men.
Yeah.
What the sort of big news is that Timlos has now become approved for use in men, whereas prior to a couple of days ago or a week or two ago, it was not. So what men were still being treated for osteoporosis with FDA approved medications prior to a week or two ago, they were being treated with Forteo, they were being treated with Prolia, they were being treated with bisphosphonates, and all of those were FDA approved, you know, on label uses. But prior to very recently, there were no men who were being treated with Timlos outside of a clinical research situation because if a doctor tried to prescribed Timlos to a patient before very recently, the insurance company would have said, oh, that's not an FDA approved indication because the data that was available only supported the use in women, most specifically in postmenopausal women. There was no reason to think that it wouldn't have worked in men. It's just that the data wasn't there until more recently.
And that's goes to show you put your ads out there and they put the word men pretty big.
Yeah.
And so of course, all of a sudden you start thinking, but I thought, wait a minute, why are they really blowing up the word men, which is good awareness for men in osteoporosis, but that makes sense. And so the last drug I'm going to talk about is very confusing, whether you're a healthcare provider, a doctor, or even a patient. And brand name is Evenity, you know, and of course the generic name is always hard to pronounce, Romosuzumab.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and it really works on something called sclerostin. Can you just explain to me in super layman's terms, sclerostin, and how is that going to really kind of apply to the osteoclast and all that kind of stuff? And where does this drug fall in? Because now I'm really confused. I have options now. So where does this fall into your treatment algorithm?
So Evenity is also a monoclonal antibody. So it's kind of similar in that one sense to Prolia. They're both biologic agents.
But how come when I read this article, they put it under anabolic agent?
Because it's both in it's a sense, a biologic agent and an anabolic agent, I guess, right?
We just created a new class.
There
right
we go.
Okay.
So Evenity is more of an anabolic agent than Prolia, which is not at all an anabolic agent.
Okay.
Prolia is a pure osteoclast inhibitor, pure inhibitor of the demolition team.
Okay.
So what does Evenity do? So it's a monoclonal antibody that blocks what you said, sclerostin. So what is sclerostin?
Yeah.
Sclerostin is this factor, this hormone in a sense that to some degree inhibits the construction team, it inhibits the osteoblasts, and to a smaller degree, it sort of pumps up and stimulates the demolition team, the osteoclasts, right? So sclerostin...
But pumps up the building team more.
No, I'm talking about what does sclerostin do?
Oh, by itself.
Right? Sclerostin, if left untouched, what does sclerostin do? Sclerostin does bad things, we would assume. Sclerostin is bad, okay? Sclerostin inhibits the construction team.
Bad.
Bad, and to a lesser extent, pumps up the demolition team.
Ooh,
bad.
So I hate
both
sclerostin.
Bad, right?
We don't
like
sclerostin out of our body. Okay.
So by inhibiting sclerostin,
okay,
which is what Evenity does,
okay,
you're taking the brakes off of the osteoblast.
Mm-hmm.
So you are allowing it to do construction.
Ah,
so yes, it is an anabolic agent because it's taking the brakes off of the construction team.
Nice. I mean, that's why it's a monoclonal antibody, because it's against that sclerostin protein.
Correct.
So it does do both.
Yes.
Nice.
Well, so if you look at the data and the people who are promoting Evenity, they say, well, yes, there's evidence that it's both an anabolic and an anti-resorptive in one, right?
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, if we're trying to just classify it, we usually put it in the anabolic category because it seems like the anabolic effects are probably the more profound effects than the anti-resorptive effects. So the construction effects.
This comes out, you know, and I got to tell you, it's kind of sexy. You know what I mean? It was, you know, we're doctors. Our bar is really low. What's cool, you know? So I'm going to tell you, we had bisphosphonates forever. We had, you know, PTH analogs for a while. It's a new category.
Yeah.
You kind of like a new category.
Sure.
So where does this fall into clinical practice? When would you consider using some brand name Evenity?
Still,
and how do you give it, by the way, and what dosing? How often?
Also a subcutaneous injection.
Okay.
It's actually given as two separate subcutaneous injections each time you go to get a dose. It has to be given as two separate injections to try to minimize or mitigate the effects of having a skin reaction, sort of a localized reaction, which is still a common side effect. But when they tried giving the whole dose as one injection, they are really bad injection site reactions.
It's the same day that you get both injections?
So in the same day, you would go, you'd get two injections in two different sites in your body.
Okay.
You do that once a month for 12 months.
And every time you go, it's two injections.
Two injections.
So you can't do it at home. You have to go to a healthcare provider.
Correct. So Evenity has to be given by a healthcare provider, doctor, nurse, pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
Prolia has to be given by a healthcare provider, doctor, nurse, pharmacist.
I thought it was you go at home and you inject yourself.
Only if you're a doctor, a nurse, or a pharmacist.
I guess so.
Or you otherwise have proper training to do so. Reclast, which is an IV infusion, obviously has to be given in an infusion center.
Yeah.
Forteo and Timlos, those are given at home. Those are self-injections.
Because it's daily.
Daily.
I mean, no one's going to come in because of those things.
Right.
Is your endocrine place here at USC set up? Is your staff and nursing and support staff, can they do the injections at your endocrine clinic?
Absolutely.
That's what it's meant for.
We have patients on Evenity. We have patients on Prolia. We have patients on Reclast.
Gotcha. So where does it fall in? When are you going to Evenity some person?
The Evenity, again, falls into that very high risk, severe osteoporosis category.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to consider using it as a first line agent.
Okay.
Those are the types of people you're going to use it in. So someone who's either already had an osteoporotic fracture, or someone who has very, very low T scores, or someone who, for whatever other reason, you think is very high risk for fracture.
So there is still not well-defined guidelines when it comes to some of these drugs, it sounds like. I think we're both on the same page. Bisphosphonate oral, which probably a lot of listeners are on.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a high risk, you got to give it a parenteral, meaning IV or subcutaneous.
Mm-hmm.
You could give the IV bisphosphonate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you want to commit yourself lifelong, the monoclonal antibody like a denosumab. At the same time, a daily injection, which is like a teriparatide, for example. Or once again,
It could be Evenity, which is going to be going and getting injecting, but there still isn't a clear-cut algorithm where you follow the dotted line of what you do next. It's still, there's no head-to-head trials at that high-risk level, giving it parentally, which is best. Did I say that correctly?
I generally, I mean, I think there's a lot more for us to learn.
Yeah.
And I think to your point, I mean, Evenity is the newest new drug on the market. You know, that was FDA approved in 2019. So, you know, 3 going on 4 years ago, you know, abaloparatide, not too far behind there. Like I said, teriparatide's been on the market for over 20 years now, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that still is not that long. The other major consideration here and the reason why these drugs maybe have still, why the anabolic agents haven't necessarily floated to the top, besides, you know, a lack of a safety record, or at least the lack of an established track record, is their cost, right? These medications are extremely expensive. From a, you know, a population standpoint, you know, are we should only deploy these medications on the patients who are at the highest risk, right? So that's why these guidelines and these algorithms that do exist say, you know, we shouldn't be automatically putting every patient with osteoporosis on an anabolic agent, because the anabolic agents are way more expensive by orders of magnitude compared to especially the bisphosphonates.
I can see everyone just clapping right now. Like, you're my favorite endocrinologist. One last thing is, I don't want to end it on a drug note.
Sure.
Because we drugged it up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Any just lifestyle changes you like to tell your patients about osteoporosis, things that, you know, they could just do?
Yeah. So we talked earlier about calcium and vitamin D.
Yep.
A lot of my patients ask me about other vitamins and supplements and minerals and things like that. So some patients ask me about magnesium, boron, strontium, vitamin K. and there certainly is there's some evidence you could find for all of these things, right?
Okay.
But I would say that the evidence to support their use in terms of either preventing bone loss or, more importantly, preventing fracture risk is pretty flimsy. To be honest, the evidence to support using calcium and vitamin D is pretty flimsy too, like we talked about.
Okay.
But at least there's more evidence behind those than a lot of these other things I said. So when patients ask me, Dr. Barnett, what do you think about me taking fill in the blank with any supplement that is not calcium or vitamin D?
Yeah.
My usual response to them is, I don't have any reason to believe it's harmful. And if you want to take it, I don't have a problem with you taking it, but I'm not telling my patients to go out and get these things. Okay?
Well said.
So that's as far as other vitamin supplements, things like that go. Patients ask, are there things I should avoid in terms of food, supplements, whatever? Generally, the answer here is things that we know are not good for our overall health are also not good for our bones. So things that probably people are trying to minimize or avoid already: alcohol consumption, tobacco consumption, caffeine consumption. Sometimes I say this to patients and they give me this big wide-eyed look like, oh my God, I can't believe the doctor's telling me to stop consuming caffeine. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm just saying, be mindful of your consumption, try to minimize it, or you know, if you're drinking 5 cups of coffee a day, try to tone it down to a few less, right?
If you're sweating and tachycardic, that may be a little too much.
Tone it down. We also know that carbonated soft drinks, so Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, but also diet soft drinks, Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi, Diet Dr. Pepper. There's certain elements in these soft drinks, phosphoric acid, that we think, it's postulated, might be related to loss of bone, maybe a higher fracture risk. Although, again, it's, you know, there's probably things, a lot worse things out there you could do than a diet soft drink, but there's lots of reasons to avoid them as well.
What about going to the gym?
Okay. So, so then people ask, well, what about exercise? The short story or the big picture here people that are more physically active have fewer fractures than people that are less physically active. So I tell my patients, pick an activity that you like to do, that you enjoy doing, that is practical for you to do, and that you feel comfortable and safe doing it, and do it regularly. Because we also have pretty good evidence to show that the regularity, the consistency is more important, is probably more important than doing, you know, one really good activity, but doing it very infrequently,
Of course.
I tell patients, you know, weight bearing exercise, you know, always gets thrown out there as the thing to do. And I love weight bearing exercise. I think patients should do it. But if they don't like doing weight bearing exercise, if they don't feel comfortable doing weight bearing exercise, if it's not practical for them to do it because they don't want to join a gym and they don't have the stuff at home and they don't want to get it, I tell patients, you know what, just pick any activity that you like doing and just do it regularly.
I agree. Even if it's just a walk around the neighborhood.
That's better than nothing.
Better than nothing.
And doing it consistently is more important than doing, you know, weight-bearing exercise or resistance training, but only doing it, you know, once a month.
Yeah. Well, dude, are you ready to give me a double high five? Dude, you know why we did that, everyone? Is because this is the first Dr. Raj podcast in person. I just dragged him from his office here at USC and put him in my office. But thank you so much for coming today.
My pleasure.
I already know that I'm going to have you back. You know what you're going to do next with me?
Hit me.
Thyroid.
Okay.
Now that it's recorded, you're going to do thyroid with me. But everyone, I know I'm in a little overboard on this, but I'm actually going to put this not only on the Dr. Raj podcast, but my other podcast is called Beyond the Pearls. And I think that we have a fine balance of how knowledge is for everyone. It's for healthcare professionals and just for our patients, for everyone. And I think, you know, Dr. Barnett does such a good job in explaining things. I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. And I'll see you again soon on the Dr. Raj podcast.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of Ars Longa Media. Our producers are Madison Linden and Chris Breitigan. Our executive producer is Dr. Patrick Beeman. This podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended for medical advice. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.